This is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 55, and today I'm joined in beautiful Umbria, Italy, in Città di Castello, at the Collegium Phenomenologicum, by Larry Hetab, who is Louis J. Jaffe Professor of Philosophy and Eminent Scholar at Old Dominion University. Larry is the author of numerous books and articles on 19th and 20th century philosophy, and he has written extensively on Nietzsche, including Nietzsche's Life Sentence, Coming to Terms with Eternal Recurrence, New York, Routledge, 2005, and Nietzsche's on Genealogy of Morality in New York, Cambridge University, 2008, which has been translated into Portuguese, I saw, 2010. He's also written The Ethics and Finitude, Heideggerian Contributions to Moral Philosophy, Experiment in Postmodern Politics from Open Court in 1995, so many, many wonderful texts. Today, and he's working on a book now on language. Today, he is here on the Digital Dialogue to talk about his paper that he gave this morning at the Collegium called Aristotle and the Tragedy of Life. And I'm also joined by Emma Bianchi, who is Assistant Professor of Comparative Literature at New York University. And she's completing a manuscript entitled The Feminine Symptom, Aleatory Matter in the Aristotelian Cosmos. And she talked a little bit about that project on Digital Dialogue 24, so we'll post that on the blog so that people can give a listen to that. And I'm also happy to be joined by Eric Jimenez, who is a recent graduate of the New School. Actually, Larry, you have the privilege to be here with three New School graduates, so that's great. He is longtime editor of the Graduate Faculty Philosophy Journal, an excellent editor of that journal, and I'm happy to say that he is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Navarra in Spain, which will be starting that this fall. So welcome everyone to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
So what I'd like to start with, Larry, maybe is just to have you talk a little bit about the paper that you gave today, a really wonderful paper on Aristotle and the Tragedy of Life, and generated a lot of discussion this morning. So we hope to continue that discussion today on the Digital Dialogue.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Paper was an experiment, really, and I was glad to be invited because then it enabled me to work it out. And my suspicion has been that Aristotle, his defense of tragedy in the Poetics might have been indicative of a larger tragic element in his entire philosophy. So I was trying to work out to what extent that might be true. And in the paper, I began by identifying certain tragic elements in early Greek literature and philosophy, the pre-Socratics, basically built around the idea of essential limits to form and limits to knowledge, limits to agency and control. And then Plato's critique of the tragic in the Republic as a kind of rebellion against this earlier element in favor of a more stable philosophy of form. And then with Aristotle's inheritance of philosophical reason from Plato. Nevertheless, I was wondering if there was a kind of dialectical relationship between Plato, between the early thinking and Plato and then Aristotle, because Aristotle certainly keeps the idea of rationality and intelligibility. But I thought that there might be still an echo of earlier tragic elements. And the way that I tried to do that is to show first of all, in various texts, I covered the physics, De Anima, the Nicomachean Ethics, the Poetics, and the Metaphysics. Now, in the physics, I pointed out the element of chance and how chance is something indigenous to reality and that, therefore, the entirety of nature cannot be understood systematically as ordered or intelligible, but chance coexists with intelligibility and order. And then in De Anima and the biological works, and I consulted a number of works that are not often treated, like on the length and shortness of life, youth, old age, and death, generation of animals, and so on, that it seems to me to be the case that Aristotle has this notion of biological life as intrinsically finite. In other words, that the idea of limits, the idea of generation, becoming, and decay, are intrinsic to Fuzes or intrinsic to sublunar Fuzes, and a number of texts indicate that. And so life in general seems to have a certain tragic structure. And I mentioned the nutritive soul, too, and how nourishment, interesting ways in which Aristotle talks about nourishment, as a fundamental cycle of self-ingestion, mm-hmm. so to speak, that to live requires the destruction of other life forms and so on. And then in Nicomachean Ethics, mentioned these occasional remarks in the Ethics about the potential failure of happiness and fulfillment for the good person. He just mentions it occasionally, indicates Priam as an example of someone who was a good person but nevertheless came to ruin. And it's odd in a way because it's almost casual.
Yeah.
And as I said, Plato's Republic seems to be dedicated, the entire book seems to be dedicated to overcoming such a thing. And yet the Poetics seem to me to be a kind of elaboration of these points, because the Poetics, I think, zeroes in on the ethical challenges of tragedy, because he talks about the idea of a good person suffering a downfall through no fault of their own. And this is morally tragic. And so I tried to analyze Aristotle's account of tragedy by way of moral limits. And then finally, with the metaphysics, I have played with something that has often intrigued me, and that is that the prime mover moves things by attraction and not creation, and so that the movement of things is drawn by love for the eternity and perfection of pure energeia. And it occurred to me once that this is a rather tragic outlook, because the very reason why things move in the way that they do is because of the draw of something that for sublunar Fuzes is incapable of being fully achieved. In other words, full actuality is not possible for natural beings, and yet full actuality is the thing that draws things to move in the way that they do in the first place. So it seemed to me that this is a kind of a tragic thing, namely that I called it unrequited love, in a way, that things move the way they do because of a pure actuality, but are so constituted that they could never achieve such a thing.
And there's one account of this notion of Eros actually, Ross gives this account of Eros in his interpretation of God as it has to move by desire, because it's the only kind of motion that's not reciprocal in Aristotle. Every
right.
other kind of motion is moved and being moved.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think that lends some credibility to what you called this unrequited love. Although
yeah.
I think probably Eric and Emma probably have many things to say about the Eros erotic dimension of Aristotle's cosmology and philosophy. But I think one of the things that I've been trying to think through in that regard is the way in which not only are we attracted to the divine in this kind of way, but actually I think that the structure of Eros in book 12 of the Metaphysics is it also attracts us to one another, because there's a sense in which this notion of eromenos, which is the word he uses there, is not just our attraction to it, but we are attracted to one another, and there's a possibility of some kind of less dyadic
right.
nature of this dimension. But I don't.
Right.
I have a lot of questions, about details. But
yeah.
I have one very general question or comment or whatever. But and it has to do with distinctive ways in which we relate to something like a possibility for tragedy and our relationship to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And one way to draw that distinction in Aristotle would be to say that there are certain things that happen that are not up to us, and there are things that are up to us.
Right.
And it strikes me that tragedy is firmly in the second domain.
Yep.
That tragedy has to do with certain consequences that follow from our decisions. It's in the domain of praeresis. And I wonder if what's going on in Lambda is actually rather different. Particularly because, and here I'm thinking about something you alluded to earlier, that it's in as much as we strive to reproduce ourselves in, as you know, mating and so forth, that we strive toward the divine. This is the only mention, incidentally, in De Anima of the divine explicitly.
Is in
that book two conversation about nutrition. And I wonder if our connection to the divine is less, in other words, less about the consequences of the decision, which would open up the possibility of tragedy, than it is about a certain notion of inevitability. And I liked your distinction, or some of the sort of deconstructive points that you made about necessity today.
No, that's a good point. I wish you would have asked that actually today. That's a great point. It seems to me, yes, you could understand this in a kind of cosmological sense in terms of the way that nature is constructed and the way that events unfold. But then in the human sphere, you're going to get a much more complicated scenario about decisions, for instance. And yeah, I think it's right that one of the reasons why Aristotle focuses on the structure of tragedy in terms of the way things unfold is that he seems to want to insist that a tragic outcome also has to involve the decisions and actions of the character. It can't be something totally passive and one-sided. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it seems to me it's a kind of an extension of the very idea of chance that he has. In other words, you have each line of nature is telic in the sense that any movement is telic in its own sense, but there's no systematic order, and that therefore telic lines can intersect accidentally, and when they intersect there can be what he would call chance events, and whatever the outcome of that intersection is, that's by chance. And so it seems that Oedipus's story is a perfect example of that. There was an intersection of events that were by chance, but that nevertheless were momentous in terms of the outcome. So he seems. I think this is a good point. The tragic in the human sphere would be a more complicated thing than if we wanted to talk about tragedy in nature in a general sense. I think in a general sense, what you said is right. That there's kind of an inevitably inscribed limitation in things, and then there's chance and so on. But a tragedy is about a human life, and a human life is going to involve, or it seems for Aristotle, must involve human active decisions, but that nevertheless create outcomes that are unexpected and undeserved. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's a good one.
Okay.
We want to distinguish between the human and the human and the natural.
Yeah, did you want to?
Well, I was going to sort of maybe return a little bit to what Chris was talking about, so do you want to?
Well,
just
I was just,
respond?
Yeah, so quick follow up. If we're buying the distinction, then what's tragic about human life, and let me just articulate a premise here really quickly, which is that I take it, and I think this is how you were interpreting it too, that lambda is basically kinetic. That is to say, it has to do with motion and nature in general. Then that couldn't relate to the domain of the tragic within human life. In other words, if there is this distinction between the domain of things that are up to us and the domain of things that aren't up to us, and lambdas of the second sort,
mm-hmm.
then the unmoved mover has no relationship to tragedy within the context of human action, distinctively human action.
Mm.
Can I just add to this, actually, that one of the ways that I understand the operation of the prime mover in the cosmos is as mimetic, and so therefore the heavenly bodies want to be as much as possible like the prime mover, and this is why they move in this circular way, in a sense of it's a physical manifestation or a spatial manifestation of the circularity of the noesis, noesios. And then in the sublunar realm, this is transformed, the spatiality is transformed into a temporal circularity, that of cyclicity, the cyclicity of generations.
Right. Right.
So there's a sort of transmission of a mimetic there's a mimetic echoing at each level, and at the same time there's a mechanical transmission, which is that by virtue of the slant of the ecliptic, of the sun's ecliptic, the seasons move, but the sun moves back and forth, creating the cyclicity of the seasons. So there's sort of through this rectilinear slant, kataton loxon, he says, there's a sort of construction of this temporal cyclicity out of spatiality. Which is a sort of maybe a roundabout way of saying that I'm actually extremely sympathetic to this approach of yours, because I see, I understand this as a kind of there being a sort of activity of fallenness in the Aristotelian cosmos that I read according to this notion of the symptom, which, as we know, is from the Greek symptoma, which means falling together, which precisely, I think, echoes this notion of yours of a tragic character in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this maybe puts the the question of human tragedy aside for a second, or of literary tragedy aside.
I think it fits well with this notion that that it's both, there's both structure and chance, that the structure of the cosmos itself is in a certain sense tragic, as which is what you, I think, were arguing there in the paper.
Well, the fact that he doesn't seem to have any kind of single rubric for the cosmos,
mm-hmm.
that he seems to simply indicate the telic motion, the telic movements of things that occasionally will intersect accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't create any kind of problem for him. He just seems to acknowledge it as just part of the way things are. Sometimes things happen by chance and some things not. And I guess in the terms of the paper, I was just simply trying to link that with things that seem to have been evident in earlier Greek expression, right? Because the idea of the gods, the ways of the gods were, from the human standpoint, matters of chance. One might wonder what the gods were about, but from the human standpoint, one could never divine why it is they do what they do. So the idea of chance was a kind of a basic element of life, and that here you have Aristotle sort of giving a formal cosmological account of the fact that chance is a characteristic of life, but that nevertheless doesn't eliminate purpose. It's only predicated on the fact that there's no single telos to the cosmos. There's no single way to wrap up the whole package. Right?
But I mean, I think, and maybe as a way to get all four of us into a topic that is, in a way, it's certainly part of a long, ongoing discussion that Emma and I have had, which is the way in which, let's take a step back in a way and talk about the work that the prime mover is doing in the structure of Aristotelian thinking. And the question of whether let me put it in these terms and see how it goes. You know, the desire to posit this principle that sort of seems to secure the order of things, that in, you know, something that Emma and I have talked a lot about with regard to the teleological structure of the cosmos. The desire to posit that, and Larry, you said this morning that you saw that as a moment where Aristotle was not being phenomenological. You can get a really robust reading of Aristotle as a phenomenologist, and yet, you know, you come to this point, and there seems to be a kind of desire to posit this principle of order, and there are even places in Lambda where he seems to say, look, if God weren't pure energia, it would get tired, and we would have decay, and we would have a real problem with the ongoing structure of the universe.
Mm-hmm. And he does indicate those poetic and pre-Socratic possibilities that he rejects, like
so,
night coming first and indeterminacy coming first.
So I mean, I think that gets to a lot of the issues we're all kind of working around. And I mean, I've been trying, probably much to Emma's chagrin, to try to somehow say, but of course, actually, I think I'm more, Eric is
I've been running away from Lambda as fast as
I
can.
Exactly. I think that may be the healthiest response.
I think it's the consequence of his methodology in a sense, in that one of the first questions he always wants to ask is, what is the for the sake of which of this thing? And insofar as there's a telos, there's a for the who Heneka. This is inevitably substantialized, it seems to me. And
I think that's right. I mean, I do think that in the biological works, he is pretty rigorous about treating the telos phenomenologically, namely the for the sake of which shows itself. If we observe the way animals relate to one another and or relate to the world, they're purposive. That they do things for reasons, and reasons we can understand.
Mm.
So that then it does. It can. I can see how it gets extended.
And organs exist for reasons, right. And dental structure exists for reasons, and.
Okay. But I'm very hesitant about ascribing continuity between just to take a proximate example, the zeta eta theta conversation and the lambda conversation, because they're extremely different in kind. I think. In the metaphysics. Zeta, eta, theta ask questions about the composition of individuals. Lambda is asking a question about the composition of all beings, and which is why he uses this trope at the beginning about how if you eliminated substances, there would be nothing. So that's the question he's addressing himself to. And I take it that the consequence of the discussion in Lambda 4 to 5, where he asks this question, in what sense are the principles of change in different individuals the same? And his answer is, they're only analogically the same. That then the premise for the rest of the discussion is that the answers we get to the question, what are the principles governing movement in general, don't apply without qualification to the principles governing the movement of individuals. So I'm very skeptical about saying, moving from the level of the lambda 6 to 10 conversation to the individual substance level and saying something like the unmoved mover ultimately is responsible for motions in my sort of everyday life. I'm very hesitant about that link.
But how deep would that cut go? Because if you make it deep enough, then you've got a real cleavage in the Aristotelian cosmos.
You,
right?
I don't think you have a cleavage. This is sort of something I've been thinking about since Frank's talk yesterday. You don't have a cleavage if you assume that for the purposes of explaining individual motions, the actuality that is the individual suffices as a basic principle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mm-hmm. a question of perspective. I think the perspective question here is all important.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's right. Although, I mean, there is a sense in which what Emma was talking about the cyclical dynamic of the sublunar cosmos and the manner in which we are, we have to submit ourselves to the turnings of the Earth and the mm-hmm. sun and moving, you know, the sun moving across the sky and growth and decay. I mean, I think that, and that's something that you, Larry, really pointed to nicely in the paper. I thought about the tragic nature of even the nutritive soul, right? Even though, you know, looking at nature abstracted from human existence, you maybe wouldn't call it, it's just nature unfolding, right? It's animals killing one another to live. But there is a dimension of tragic, and I think maybe we could talk a little bit more about what the tragic means in that context, but go ahead, Emma.
Well, I just wanted to maybe draw a distinction between two different kinds of desire, and this is a Freudian distinction, between a sort of mimetic desire to be like something, and I think really that's what's principally going on in this natural sense of love for the prime mover, especially in the superlunary sphere.
Okay, but just one second about that, because so what that part of what it means to want to be like the prime mover in that sense is to want to have relationships with other people such that you will have progeny, right? Doesn't it mean?
That's kind of taking a few steps back, though. That's like a kind of mean. What it means and ends.
Well, but I mean, isn't that an expression of how our desire to participate in the immortal plays itself out in the human in the sublunar sphere?
Yeah, yeah. But I was going to contrast this with another kind of desire, which is, you know, a desire to kind of have once and for all or to reach. And I think, you know, part of what Larry's account turns on is this idea of there's something that you want to reach and you can't quite get there, and it won't reciprocate. You'll never have what you want. In a sense, you know, we were talking about this in relation to the Aristophanes Aristotle's critique in the Politics of the Symposium of Eros as a sort of merging, having as its telos a kind of merging. I can't not associate this kind of fallenness or this sort of inability to reach the prime mover as, you know, a fundamental quality of matter itself. And I mean, you didn't really talk about that. Maybe I can push you on that a bit. Because he does say, it might be at the end of Lambda, that it's on account of matter's indeterminacy and plurality, and specifically the matter's indeterminacy and plurality. And he uses the word symptoma in that passage also, that these sort of cycles continue and that nature is what it is, basically. So it's the precondition, the condition of possibility of nature there's a gulf that's not attainable.
Let me take a step back, because there's really a sense in which, when I was trying to work this thing out, I wasn't really trying to say, and Aristotle was deliberately saying what I said he was saying. I just was curious about the way in which he was describing things and how it seemed to unfold in a way that seemed to me to be tragic, right? And so there's a number of ways to look at this. On the one hand, I think Aristotle was much more of a Greek than Plato was. I mean, Aristotle was much more typical of the Greek mind and the Greek way of seeing things than Plato was. And the inheritance of the Greeks with their stories about limits and so on, this is a sort of, you know, their lifeblood in a way. And so it could be that either when Aristotle was working out his systems, if there was anything that would occur in the manner that I described it, it wouldn't be shocking to him, right? The very way that he would look at tragedies as something he says, no, this is useful, important, and you know, rather than to Plato, shocking. I mean, tragedies are morally shocking to Plato. But that's because the Greek tradition has been, you know, sustained, nurtured on these things. So I guess my point was that I really think that he was a phenomenologist in the way that he was dedicated to the idea of thinking things through in terms of how they manifest themselves to it. That's his basic starting point. And everything he does, he tries to be faithful to phenomena.
Yeah, that's right.
The metaphysics, I think it leaps to another direction. But because of his, he does inherit the Platonic value of ultimate intelligibility. He inherits that, he doesn't lose that, and that sort of causes him to try to make these final moves. But my point was that even in doing that, given the way I analyzed it, it still has a strangely tragic structure to it.
I want to push that. I mean, you know, you're being nice and humble about that, about, you know, I was just interested in it and it sort of came out that way. But I wonder, and I think I would make a stronger claim and argue that because Aristotle is such a good phenomenologist, because he is able to so effectively articulate the structure of the way nature shows itself, the way things show themselves, and put words to those.
Right.
That he is able to give voice to the tragic structure of the unfolding of the cosmos. And he does so even in the metaphysics, in Book Lambda. In fact, in a way that's actually poignant, and I'm still not sure what to ultimately do with it. I mean, I tried to argue for a certain thing in the Aristotle on Truth book, but you know, and the argument was that even in the very articulation of noesis, 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 there is embedded in there a dimension of dunamis that he is unwilling to legitimize because he has this other side, maybe what you're calling the
platonic flashback
dimension,
flashback
that cannot allow that flashback. But of course, then my other problem is that then I often fall into, and Frank took me to task, and rightly I think at one point in my first book about I begin to psychologize Aristotle, say sort of he just can't abide that there might be this actual openness, that it might be this dunamis, this material dimension. To put it that way, at the beginning,
but he says much
at the heart of everything.
But he says as much in the metaphysics. He says, "Well, there are indications in our tradition that have tried to say as much, but that's impossible."
It's
he says.
And
now, the fact that he says it's impossible.
But it's a posit. I think it's a posit that he makes in the Shermanian sense of he sees it, and then he posits. He posits that it can't be.
Right,
and that's a real problem. Now I have trouble not thinking about that in psychological terms and sort of psychologizing Aristotle. But I do think maybe that there's a moment there of real critical recognition that then maybe gets covered over, or maybe it comes to language in a way that allows the deremption or the openness to show itself. And that's really what I mean when I talk about legomenology, is that it comes to language in a way that allows that dimension of dunamis to continue to show itself, even as he is trying to posit absolute pure energeia.
Yeah.
One of the important details, I think, though, about, and I think this is behind your point, Chris, but one of the important details about lambda is that the argument he gives for the identity and constitution of the unmoved mover is, I would say, a phenomenological argument about the terms governing animal movement. So there's that argument in Lambda 6 and 7, mm-hmm. I can't remember which chapter it falls into, but the argument that we move by means of nous and desire, that's the argument he gives, and it's very much taken from the context of animal motion, and taken from I would say a phenomenological context.
Well, the very way you put it, you said it phenomenologically in the terms of the terms of life. That to me is the switch, right? Instead of dealing with phenomena and how they manifest themselves, now he's dealing with key ideas that are part of his analysis, and then he says, "Well, it cannot be that dunamis could precede energeia." Now, that to me is not phenomenological. That is, he has now shifted, mm-hmm. I think, to an ideological point.
But I mean, I think Aristotle, it's not just the influence of Plato. I think Aristotle sees the intelligible structure of the universe appear. I mean, it is a matter of appearance, that nature shows itself in structural ways that are intelligible, that are understandable, and he's trying to put words to that.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to this, Emma. You, one of the advantages of having a face-to-face conversation is when I brought the dunamis question together with the material question, you cringed a little bit. So can we go back maybe to that moment? If you can recall it.
I just don't see how you can sort of just say he really thinks the prime mover has matter in it or something like that. I don't know.
Well, okay. No, it's not that this brings up a larger issue about how Larry was characterizing it also today. So let me push the point and then you can add at me. Which is that, okay, Larry, you sort of made it seem like, well, and I've said something similar in the book on the ethics of ontology, where, well, the only thing God could think is himself, because there's nothing else. I mean, it's not like... it's the only thing that wouldn't destroy his ability to think.
Mm-hmm.
But in the truth book, I try to argue more convincingly that what is actually thought is the very intelligibility of the world, and that God is what I call relationality. It's not relational, but relationality, namely, the opening of the very possibility of our relating to one another, or things relating to one another. And if that's the case, if something like that is possible as a reading, and not necessarily as a reading of what Aristotle intended, but I try to show what comes to language in the text, then there is a dimension of openness, and I think that's what I'm trying to get at with regard to dunamis embedded in the noesis, noeseos, noesis, the genitive of noeseos. It cracks the pure energeia open to a dimension of dunamis that has to be there if we're going to talk about God as life and other kinds of things in a literal way. And then it would also still be material, because what God would be thinking would just be the intelligible unfolding of the cosmos.
Except I think this actually kind of brings me back to, yeah, you know, I think what is one of my disagreements with Larry's thesis, which is this question of how, you know, the idea of that somehow chance, materiality, and so on have a kind of equal dignity as the three causes in nature that are telos, form, and the moving cause. Mm-hmm. So,
but I mean, there in that sense, he does in the physics say those three are can be reduced.
Yes,
to one form,
right.
That's, and yet there's this thing that can't be reduced.
That's right. And so matter is this irreducible site of indeterminacy, of plurality, and so on. I think he sort of just clearly or constantly sort of reiterates a hierarchy in relation to this. And, you know, so if I can just sort of go back to the generation of animals, I think it's a kind of central text for both of us. You know, there's these phenomena of automaton in there, which are not spontaneous generation, which aren't really just telic crossings. There's some other quality in matter that is strangely sort of untheorized and seems to function something like a kind of subterranean archaekinesios here and there. I mean, even in that passage at the end of Physics 1.9, matter stretching out toward form, as the female stretches out to the male and the ugly stretches out toward the beautiful, you've got this subterranean, I mean, it's matter behaving itself in those cases. It's being appropriate for, as Heidegger would say. But there are these other ways that matter functions to be disruptive, unruly, disobedient, inappropriate, that I think he's constantly polemicizing against. Mm-hmm. And so you said at the beginning, you know, your formulation of this indigeneity of chance to Aristotle's natural system, mm-hmm, I think is something I would want to push back against. You know, I mean, he's constantly coming up with these formulas of this happens, mm-hmm, this occurs against nature. Nature, mm-hmm, has, you may want to say, oh, it's part of nature to act against itself, but he doesn't say that. He says, you know, this is a phenomenon paraphusin, against nature, because it's not something that's happening always and for the most part. It's not something that's governable by the understandable in sort of the simple terms of the four essential causes.
Well, I wouldn't have said that he gives chance a kind of a co-equal status.
Yeah.
I simply said that he acknowledges it.
Yeah, well, he certainly does.
And in other words, the fact that he simply is being a phenomenologist by saying, well, look, some things happen against our expectation and that are unpredictable and unexplainable. Mm-hmm. But that's because, he says, as I read him, that each thing is intelligible in its own movement, but there's no systematic order to it, and that therefore there are intersections that are accidental.
Yeah.
So he simply will acknowledge it. That could still include the fact that he might want to have a governing attitude towards chance, to whatever extent that it is possible. But I'm pretty convinced that he says, and in the metaphysics, I forget where the passage, he says chance is inevitable in Fusus because of certain characteristics that he lays out, like the different telic lines and the nature of matter itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as far as I could tell, He that decay, for instance, is intrinsic to Fusus, sublunar Fusus, because of, as he says, it's this elemental configurations. The elements exchange each other in terms of combination and disintegration, and this is the nature of matter, and that's why any particular natural thing that's composed of the elements cannot sustain itself inevitably. It must It either is done accidentally by external means or internally by way of inevitable material disintegration. So now, I don't think I have any problem with the kind of the polemical attitude that he can have now and again. I'm just simply saying, well, despite all that, he seems, and again, this is the phenomenologist in him, he says, I'm not going to say anything that I can't get away with. And he seems to be saying, even if we're going to try to govern Fuzes as much as we possibly can, there is a limit to what we can do.
Yeah.
Now, what to make of that? How much status to give that? That I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But and in fact, I would say probably Aristotle would minimize the tragic, if there is anything to what I'm saying. He would probably minimize it, but the fact that it's there at all is the thing that I was trying to say.
Yeah. You know, I have to say that, you know, your paper this morning really made me think in some new and very provocative ways about this system, you know, and the fact that you deal with so many texts and so on, and especially the way that, you know, that you managed to integrate the poetics into the metaphysics somehow, I think is extraordinarily compelling.
Although I have to say Eric's point is important about it, and I would have tried to work this out. You want to make distinctions between what I mean by the tragic, if it manifests metaphysically, and then the way it would manifest in tragedy, in poetics. So anyway.
But I just wanted to explain a little bit this notion of the feminine symptom that I've sort of developed, which is looking at how the how sexual sexual reproduction operates, and when you have this sort of split into a material principle, or he calls prote hule, prime matter, not that such a thing is supposed to exist otherwise, in the womb and the semen, which contains the three other principles, moving principle, a logos, and a telos.
But not nous,
a soul principle. A soul principle.
And
a rational soul principle, which is what the female is unable. She's unable to produce this. So the question then arises: if the form is coming from the male, how do you get a female offspring? How is that possible? And what he comes up with is that there has to be some kind of misstep, some kind of mistake. There's not enough heat. There's, you know, the wind's in the south, or the wind's in the, some. You know, he has some various exciting explanations for this. How this accidental, chancy, random event can happen.
Yeah.
Something goes wrong, and yet this mistake also ends up being absolutely necessary and central to the teleology.
Which is weird.
And that's what I'm calling the symptom, in that it's both internal to the, absolutely essential and necessary, in the most teleological sense, the necessity ex hypothesios, right, or conditional necessity. And at the same time, its etiology is that of the absolute, you know, randomness, plurality, disruptive quality of matter, the same quality that gives rise to so-called freaks of nature, you know, he says calves with two heads, or babies born with six fingers and so on, a mild form of monstrosity. You know, I think you've got this really interesting figure in the female, of a kind of this, you know, indeterminately teleological on the one hand, and then also in terms of the teleology, and as we see in the politics, lower down on the hierarchy, fit to be ruled, and to have a sort of serving kind of courage rather than a leading kind of courage, and so on and so forth.
Well, first of all, the question about politics and the question about this is something I have no ability to address in terms of the way that so far I've done that. And yet I see it as important.
So I guess I just wanted to add, so that there's this way that teleology itself, I think, is revealed in this structure as giving rise very clearly to a hierarchical cosmos, they're structurally
interdependent. But it's giving rise to a hierarchical cosmos, if I'm taking your point, and
in which the that principle that gives rise to it is itself, in a way, not permitted into it.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And that's part of the meaning of the symptom.
Exactly. Right.
Something, one question, and this is something that I'm thinking a little bit about, it has to do with the status of chance in physics. And I take a very strong reading of the argument there, but there's an ambiguity. And the way that I read the argument is that what Aristotle is saying is that chance only appears under the aspect of deliberation. In other words, things in nature only appear as chance events if I'm somebody who has a deliberative capacity. So, you know, he says we go to the market and we think we by chance run into somebody we owe money to. The only reason it seems by chance is because our deliberative capacity had directed us elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And I think my strong reading is to say that chance there, Aristotle's saying, only exists for, okay. There are two ways, I think, to hear that. And one way is to say that there is no chance in nature. And this would be, I think that would be, in a certain sense, harmonious with some of the things you've been saying, Emma. Would be, this is Aristotle sort of liquidating nature of chance or fortuitousness or whatever. But another way to read it would be just to say that things happen in nature that we perceive as chance events, but that aren't chance events at all. And I think that, I mean, I'm inclined toward the second way of reading it, that, you know, it's not that there is no chance, it's just that nature appears to us as chance given our composition. And but I think and I just can't think of another metaphor. I feel like this is a, but anyway, that reading chance that way in the physics is pregnant with other interpretive possibilities for thinking about chance in a sort of inarticulated or unarticulated dimension in Aristotelian thinking. That there is a sort of abiding, and this is what I really liked about something that Larry said. That there's a sort of abiding component of necessity or of nature that is inflected as chance only because of the way we perceive it. I mean, you could run through everywhere in Aristotle where he says this happens by chance and say, what if you were consistent with the account of chance in physics? This isn't chance, right? It's only chance because of the way that you're thinking of it. Or it only appears to you as chance given certain prejudices.
Well, I think you're right about some of the examples that he uses, but it would seem to me really odd if Aristotle were capable of coming up with a modern-style deterministic system. I don't see any evidence for that.
The evidence goes the other
it's
way.
It's not a law-governed cosmos, that's for sure.
But when he talks about chance and necessity in relation to violence, for example, it seems to me quite clear. What he means by violence is the unnatural intersection of forces. In other words, violence done to a being is done to it contrary to its natural path. And that seems to imply to me that it's possible for these paths to intersect in a way that is not natural. And the only way for me to make sense of that is to have distinct telic lines that occasionally intersect. I wouldn't know how else to understand it.
Right.
But, I mean, I think there's a way in which that... I mean, you were arguing today that it's not just... That it's in the very structure of nature and the way nature unfolds to have this kind of encounter with limits and then the sort of inability to transcend those limits in a way that might be desirable, right? But maybe a word or two about the nature of tragedy and its relationship to limits, because I took what you were saying as beyond, humans have a particular kind of ability to attend to the tragic nature of life. But you're also arguing that life itself has a tragic structure.
Yeah. Well, but it is important, as I said, that Eric's point is well taken,
right,
that there is a kind of a tragedy to physis in principle, if I'm at all right. But then there is the tragedy of the human sphere, which, as far as I can see, in the Poetics, he is, and this is not the full measure of tragedy, but it's what Aristotle wants to emphasize, it is the inadvertent moral ruin. that occurs. That's the thing that he wants to emphasize. There are other ways to read tragedies. You could have all kinds of angles on it. But he seems to want to say that what happens in tragedy is the person of high moral stature achieves ruin by no fault of their own. So he seems to emphasize the fact that, and I think chance figures into this, especially the Oedipus story, but nevertheless, there's a difference between human tragedy in this sense that he wants to emphasize, and then natural tragedy in the sense that all natural things are destined to dissolution and undoing. But then in the human sphere, the question is, well, yes, we're all going to die. We all know that. But then there is, well, what is the status of my happiness? That's another question. How will my life turn out in terms of its quality, not its duration? And that's what I think the tragedies speak to for him. It's that, well, even a good person might come to ruin through no fault of their own. And that's a, but I guess what I'm trying to say is I see like an analogies between the two, but I would want to distinguish between them, though, to be careful.
Can I just come back in against your conception of chance as, you know, potentially knowable? Because I think that there's something actually kind of fundamentally opaque about chance and automaton. Automaton is his word for it acting, the way that this acts purely in nature, not for us in any way, not in relation to anything that, you know, we would consider lucky or anything like that. Right. That, well, right. 2K we can translate either as luck or as chance.
Right.
But for him, it has that quality of being about the human sphere and having a moral element.
Exactly.
Whereas automaton is something that's just, you know, something happens in the natural world. And, you know, so by chance, a membrane forms around a bit of pneuma and a mollusk forms.
Or an avalanche, the rock goes into some specific direction.
I mean, I think there is some, you know, way that he touches, you know, what we think of as perhaps chaos in a contemporary mode in this notion. And that somehow this abyssal quality is a quality of matter that is, you know, somewhat abhorrent to him.
What gives you the idea that it's abhorrent?
Because I think there's just this way in the text that he polemicizes it. He doesn't want to admit these as he wants to admit them as phenomena. And I absolutely agree with you there. There's something
he can't deny
so attentive in his work, and his, you know, it's his phenomenological sort of
faithful to phenomena
fidelity, right? That
the abyssal dimension shows itself.
And I think it's there too in the account of at the beginning of it's the beginning of the physics physics 2-1 where, you know, the account of matter, form, and privation, and this capacity of that matter has to admit privation, stiresis, and so on. And maybe we could go in a Heideggerian, you know, direction with that too, as in the way that Walter Brogan does, and think about, you know, this quality of nature showing itself as privation and as and as becoming an emergence of being at the same time, and as this dual twofoldness.
But I wonder if we could just return for a second to this back to God for a second, the unmoved mover, and wonder if that the structure of, let's say, the sublunary realm's relationship to this principle, this erotic principle that seems to be at work in Aristotle's cosmos, is not exactly what drives us to limits and what drives us toward one another in ways that do unfold in tragic ways now in the sense of natural tragedy, namely the tragedy that is necessary for us to continue as a species and for other animals to, you know, survive. So I wonder if there's a way of thinking about that erotic principle as precisely driving natural beings toward a kind of what Drew Hyland would call a finite transcendence. This desire that is ungraspable, unaccomplishable. And I wonder if there's a way of reading it that way, because I have always have these two dimensions to me. On the one hand, one trying to read it as a principle of the Aristotelian cosmos, and on the other hand, as a principle that Aristotle, the thinker, posits because he recognizes and sees the feminine symptom, to put it in your language. Okay, that's way
better. Wait, he posits the prime mover because...
Yeah, because he can't deal with it. Right, this is an ultimate... he can't deal with what he... I mean, there's a reading which you can give where you should say...
But it's sort of compensatory in some way.
It's a Freudian thing, right, in a way, right? So he sees it, and he can't deal with it, so he posits.
So now we're psychologizing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think... I will admit that my first book on Aristotle is really rife with that kind of thing. He sees... And it's, you know, I was infected in a good way, I think, by Sherman's this idea. You see it, but you can't deal with it, so it comes out in the thinking in this way.
Yes.
One of the places where I think this motif that Larry's picked out is most conspicuous is the last book of the Ethics. And I think that's more what you're talking about than the Unmoved Mover.
Yeah, sure.
Frequently with teaching it, students are sort of like, but this is impossible, right? And, you know, and Aristotle himself says it's impossible. We have to sleep, we can't think all the time, we have to eat, we need ecta, etc.
You mean like the argument that contemplation is the best for us?
Yeah, and that even though we are mortals, we should, you know, strain every nerve to athanatidzein ourselves, to make ourselves, to act like immortals.
And it seemed like a kind of heroic story. Yeah.
Exactly, and I think that the impossibility of it is not a block for Aristotle. No. To its being an ideal of our action.
He sees, sees the impossibility.
He's totally
and nevertheless
exactly strives for it. But again, there are echoes enough of that in Greek tradition that, again, I'm trying to posit the fact that Aristotle, you know, wittingly or unwittingly, was simply in line with a lot of what was going on in the past, though in new ways. The theoria thing, that's new, that's not what's going on in the past, but this idea of straining to something that you even know you can't fulfill is a very common theme.
And it's very unlike, and this is why I think, and I think you're totally right here, it's very unlike Platonic piety.
Thank you.
Well, again, I think we need to have another digital dialogue on Larry's reading of Plato.
Oh, no, we can't put that on. We cannot put that on tape.
But let me take this opportunity to thank all three of you for joining me on this wonderful discussion on the digital dialogue. So this has been the Digital Dialogue.
Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. If you'd like to learn more about the Digital Dialogue, I invite you to visit my website at www.la.psu.edu/Chris Long and on the Digital Dialogue Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue. You can also find the Digital Dialogue now on Google+. Thank you for listening to the Digital Dialogue.